From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and we begin this hour with the monthly jobs report out this morning. The government's numbers for August, unfortunately, pick up where the numbers for July and June left off. In short, that means another month of modest private sector job growth, more than offset by government job cuts. The unemployment rate rose slightly to 9.6%. President Obama spoke about the new numbers in a Rose Garden press conference.
New figures show the economy produced 67,000 private sector jobs in August, the eighth consecutive month of private job growth.
The president described it as positive news.
And it reflects the steps we've already taken to break the back of this recession. But it's not nearly good enough.
Not good enough. NPR's Tamara Keith explains why.
Since the start of the year, the private sector has created more than 700,000 jobs. Sounds pretty good, right?
It's about half what we need just to keep even.
Carl Van Horn is a public policy professor at Rutgers who specializes in workforce issues. Most economists say that to keep up with population growth, the economy needs to add about 150,000 jobs a month.
When you have this deep of a hole in the labor market, it's very hard to get back because if you just do the simple math, you would have to have months and months of job growth in the 300,000 to 500,000 people level.
Or in other words, we have a long way to go. Van Horn recently completed a nationwide survey and found 3 out of 4 Americans have either lost a job or have a close friend or family member who's lost a job. In Van Horn's case, his brother-in-law and a friend from college have both been out of work for months.
The vast majority of us have been affected, and it means that we're very pessimistic about the economy for the near term.
Which is not good for the economy.
Exactly. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
In St. Louis, Missouri, business owner Steve Schulte is watching the pessimism unfold in his sales figures.
There's got to be a demand for the products. There's got to be that consumer confidence. They're willing to start spending money in order to get the whole ball rolling.
Schulte's business is called Porta King Building Systems. They make modular rooms that are used in factories. When the nation's employment situation was at its worst, he had to lay off more than half of his employees. But then this spring, business picked up and he was able to hire 20 people. Then demand fell off a cliff. Now he's talking about layoffs again.
Here I am in the midst of saying it's about time for me to start batting down the hatches again just because of the conditions that we're presently seeing.
And with conditions like that, maybe it's not a surprise that Professor Van Horn's survey found most Americans think the economy is in recession and still will be a year from now. Economist Douglas Holtz-Aiken says the economic reality is only slightly more encouraging.
The right way to think about the U.S. economy at the moment is that it is growing. It's been growing for about a year, but it is growing at an anemic pace. And that every policy effort should be focused on raising the long-term growth rate of the U.S. economy.
But for many members of Congress facing tough elections this fall, there is only the short term. President Obama plans to offer his own ideas for generating more job growth next week. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Up next, insomnia. It may mean more than just a bad night's sleep. You know that feeling? Hey, we've all been there, right? You're laying in bed, the pillows are fluffed, the lights are out, the alarm is set. You're just waiting to drift off, but that moment never comes. You're thinking, you know, if I fall asleep right now, I can still get 7 hours of sleep, right? And you look at the clock, and it's 6 hours, and then it's 5 hours, and of course, you're still wide awake. And by the morning, instead of being well rested, you feel exhausted. Well, for people with insomnia, that scenario gets played out night after night, sometimes for years. And researchers have known that insomnia is bad for your health because, you know, it's correlated with diabetes, high blood pressure. But now there's new research showing that it might increase your risk of death, at least in men. Joining me now to talk more about it is Alexandros Vagontzis. He is director of the Sleep Research and Treatment Center and professor of psychiatry at Penn State College of Medicine in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And so if you don't get how many nights sleep, what happens to your risk? If you don't get 6 hours of sleep at night, your risk goes up.
Let me explain that.
You described at the beginning, you know, the program very well for the average person, you know, what is an insomniac and what does he or she feel. It's basically a subjective complaint. I cannot fall asleep, I toss and turn, and etc. In this study, based on some previous findings, we decided to divide insomniacs based on how many hours they are asleep, but objectively measured. And I have to clarify that. Usually, you know, in the press there has been a lot of reports, so many hours of sleep and you're going to become obese.
Right.
So many hours of sleep. But this is usually self-reported. In other words, you know, how many hours you think you sleep. In our study, we used the objective sleep duration as measured in the sleep lab, using, you know, brain EEG, brain waves, etc. And we used that as a physiological marker of severity. And what we found is that those that were complaining of insomnia, and also objectively, they were sleeping less than 6 hours in this single night in our lab, there were those that they had a higher risk of dying from insomnia.
And you found that they had four times more likely to die.
That's correct. And this risk is independent, you know, of other confounding factors such as depression, age, education, obesity, smoking, alcohol, sleep apnea, high blood pressure, or diabetes. So you
figured in sleep apnea into that and still...
Correct, wow. Correct, because that was one of the advantages, you know, of our study, that we had objective sleep data for all these 1,741 men and women from Central Pennsylvania, and so we could rule out the possible effect of all these other problems, including sleep apnea, because since we brought up the subject, I think we do know that sleep apnea is not good for you in terms of high blood pressure, diabetes and mortality. What is new in our study is that we focus in the other most prevalent sleep disorder, which is insomnia, which is about 10% of the general population. 10% of people, you know, they go to their doctors and they say, I have insomnia, help me. Mm-hmm. So we're talking for a large population.
But you didn't find a correlation with women as such a great risk in the study. Why is that?
Yes. I have to make a comment here, and also a comment about press reports, media reports, particularly from the UK, that I found them a little bit confusing, and I don't think they reflect accurately what we say in our study. The main finding is, you know, that insomnia of this type, which is about 50% of all insomniacs, is associated with increased risk of mortality. We found that in men because we followed up men for a longer time, about 14 years, and the mortality rate in men was 21%. In women, the mortality rate, because we followed them up for a shorter period, it was only 5%. So our findings as far as women are inconclusive. Mm-hmm. In other words, it does not mean that insomnia is bad only for men. Our data, and we have to stick, you know, with our data, showed this finding in men. In women, because of the small sample size, of the small number that they died at the time of the follow-up, our findings are inconclusive.
Mm-hmm.
So reports, you know, they said, oh, this study found that insomnia kills men but not women, I think are inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad to correct that through your program.
People will get a chance to listen. I have about 30 seconds before the break, and then we'll come back with you. But I wanted you to talk about, what do you know what insomnia does, why it causes this higher mortality rate?
Well, that's a good question, and we don't have a specific answer. Studies from ourselves and others have shown that this type of insomnia is associated with an activation of the stress system, of the biological stress system, the system that secretes at its end, you know, cortisol and catecholamines. And we have found that this type of insomniacs, they have an increased secretion of these stress hormones.
All right.
Stress hormones are good on an acute basis, but on a chronic basis, they can cause a lot of problems, including cardiometabolic disorders.
All right. Well, stay with us. We'll be right back and talk more about sleeping and sleep problems right after this break. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Alexandros Vagantis about his study of insomnia in men, especially, which showed that there was there's a four times more likelihood of death in men who have insomnia. That doesn't mean, though, that you're going to die from insomnia, does it, Dr. Vagantis?
No, it does not. No one dies directly from insomnia. But chronic insomnia, based also on my previous comment about the stress hormones, can wear you down physically. In other words, you know, it will increase the chances of having cardiovascular problems or metabolic problems, such as hypertension, diabetes, and other problems that at this moment we have not explored and we do not have the data. So insomnia is not like, you know, you have a heart attack, but certainly may lead to these kind of problems, so indirectly contributes to your risk of death.
One last question before we let you go is, what can people do? How can we help people with insomnia so that they can sleep better?
I think, you know, the methods of this study, as well as, you know, three previous studies where we, for the first time, I will say in a clear way, we have shown that insomnia is not just a psychological problem, but has significant physical consequences, is that insomnia is a serious problem, has to be taken seriously, both by patients as well as physicians. We do have treatments for insomnia today. They are not optimum, they are not perfect, but they're there. And I think, I would suggest, whoever has that problem should discuss it with their doctor, and if their family physician does not have the specific knowledge of how to treat it, they should be referred to specific centers, primarily sleep centers, but with an expertise on insomnia. Mm-hmm.
So what your take-home message here is, if you have insomnia, it is not a harmless thing. It's not something to be ignored.
Exactly right. That's really the major message.
And you should seek help from your physician to see what you can do for it. You know, as you said before, we hear a lot about people with sleep apnea causing them to lose sleep.
Uh-huh.
But we don't hear a lot about just plain insomnia. And you're saying that this is just as big a concern and may have the same kind of consequences.
Exactly right. That's really the major point. I think all these years there has been a lot of reports about how sleep apnea is bad for you. I think now we're saying insomnia is equally bad and requires our attention at the individual level as well as, you know, the level of public health policy, federal agencies, industry investing money for new treatments, and so forth.
All right, Doctor, thank you very much for taking time to be with us, and have a good holiday weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Alexander Vagantis is director of the Sleep Research and Treatment Center and professor of psychiatry at Penn State University.
NPR reporters spend a lot of time chasing around politicians for interviews. Sometimes the encounter's in a district office, sometimes a diner. Sometimes the location unexpectedly becomes the best part of the story. So it happened to NPR political correspondent Don Gagne this week at the Stark County Fair in Northeast Ohio.
I had spent the day looking at a hot congressional race. I'd caught up with the candidates at the county fair in Canton, Ohio. I had what I needed, so I headed to the Midway.
The Stark County Junior Fair Youth Awards presentations will be starting at 7 p.m. in the pavilion.
What I found was a piece of my boyhood, rides I hadn't seen in decades, the Lupo plane, the skydiver, the scrambler. Then there were the funnel cakes, fried cheese, fried Twinkies. One brightly lit trailer was selling fried veggies, pandering to modern sensibilities. I had a corn dog. Way over on the far edge of the fairgrounds, I saw a huge sign mounted on top of a trailer. The Headless Woman, it read, still alive. A metal loudspeaker lured people in.
A real live girl. But where is her head? Can a human being stay alive with no head? How far can modern science go? Is this possible?
Let's just say it probably wasn't the best $2 I've ever spent. I skipped the attraction one lot over, a live rat weighing 100 pounds, the exhibit promised. That's when another sound lured me away from the Midway to the grandstands.
It
was a battle of the bands, high school marching bands with flag corps, baton twirlers. These were the Aviators of Alliance High School. It was fun, even if I've heard Journey's Don't Stop Believing a few hundred times too many. I came to the Stark County Fair looking for a few quotes from politicians. Sometimes you find something else. Don Gagne, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Motorcyclist Peter Lentz died after an accident at the Indy 500 track last Sunday. His death was the first at the track since 2003. Lentz may have been an experienced racer, but he was also just 13 years old. As Erica Celeste reports, the news has shaken the close-knit youth Grand Prix community made up of motorcycle racers around the world.
Peter Lentz died hours after a practice lap at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway when he fell off his bike and was run over by a 12-year-old competitor. 13-year-old Nick McFadden was also warming up on Sunday and was just seconds behind the accident. He says he and the other racers didn't realize at first how serious the accident was. Now it's difficult for him to talk about. Just 2 weeks ago, he was pitmates with Lentz at another race.
I try not to think about that stuff because it messes with your mind and makes you go slower, so I just don't think about it.
Nick is sitting in the dining room in his nicely decorated rural Kentucky home, flanked by his parents. His father, Doug McFadden, explains the philosophy that he says helps the family get through tough times like this.
There are dangers in every sport. I truly believe if it's your day to go, I own a towing business. And I see someone dead in a car every week. What's the difference? When you leave here, you may not make it to the end of the road.
Nick listens intently as his mother, Rachel McFadden, defends his right to race against the hordes of bloggers and editorial writers who question why 13-year-olds are allowed to race at speeds up to 130 miles an hour. She says her son and the other racers on the national circuit aren't average kids playing motorcycle. They're highly disciplined athletes preparing to go pro.
They've grown up knowing they are responsible for expensive machines, expensive equipment, other people's lives, their own lives. Kids that you have seen that don't seem to have that type of respect, you don't see them continue on for many years.
Eric Powell, an official with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, agrees. He says the International Federation that sanctions events like Sunday's race make sure that racers have at least 2 years' experience before they can race at the national level.
They have the most stringent standards for tracks of any entity in the world. And there's only two tracks in the United States that are sanctioned that meet their safety measures. And one is here, the other is Laguna Seca. So certainly from a track standpoint, it's about as safe as you're going to get.
The day after the accident, fans gathered at a local hangout near the speedway. Many here are also struggling to come to terms with Peter Lentz's death. Chris Leek and his wife Danielle can't get it off their minds.
At 13 years old, you're old enough to realize that things can go wrong. And I think if he comes home at night and is saying, Mom and Dad, I want this, then they're going to support that like any parent would.
Well, you can just hope and assume that the parents explain to the kid what the dangers are.
Jonathan Cohen is an orthopedic surgeon who understands those dangers. A few years ago, he conducted a safety study after his sons wanted to start racing. He discovered that the injury rate for racing and non-motorized sports follows a similar pattern. The youngest children, up to about 11, have a very low injury rate. But as they get older, that rate rises dramatically.
Their muscles are tight, they have these new lanky bodies that they're not used to using, and testosterone that tells them to move on forward. And those are the kids that
have the highest injury rates.
But Cohen stresses this doesn't mean that kids racing motorcycles are necessarily at a greater risk than those doing skateboard tricks or playing football. He cautions parents to actively work as safety advocates for their children, no matter what sport they're playing. Rachel and Doug McFadden defend the sport that has become a passion for so many Grand Prix families. They credit it with helping improve children's memory and problem-solving skills, as well as bringing families closer as they travel the circuit. Yet critics continue to question a sport that allows children to race on tiny motorcycles beginning at the age of 3. For NPR News, I'm Erica Celeste.
Bjorn Lomborg, a controversial Danish economist, has pushed his way back into the global warming debate. He's done it with a book promoting what he calls smart solutions to climate change. The book has raised eyebrows because Lomborg, who's often considered a climate change skeptic, now supports a tax on greenhouse gas emissions. But as NPR's Dan Charles reports, Lomborg is still making environmentalists very angry.
Bjorn Lomborg made a big splash almost 10 years ago with a book called The Skeptical Environmentalist. He was skeptical, for example, about evidence that humans were warming up the globe. He says those doubts got resolved.
I've said for many years, global warming is real, it's man-made, and it is an important problem.
Yet Lomborg still believes there's no point trying to solve the problem by shutting down power plants or getting people out of their cars. It's not cost-effective. He cites an economic model which estimates the effect of using a big tax on coal and gas to drive down carbon dioxide emissions. According to this model, you'd need a huge tax if you want to cut those emissions enough to keep temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial levels. The tax would be $100 per ton of carbon dioxide now, going up to $4,000 a ton a century from now. Lomborg says no one will tolerate this. The costs far outweigh the benefits.
For every dollar spent, mainly in GDP loss, you will avoid a couple of cents of climate damage.
So those UN-sponsored negotiations aimed at limiting CO2 emissions are a futile exercise, Lomborg says, and more people realize this. They're searching for a different approach.
I think we do need to shake up our negotiators and start talking about, are there other ways that we could potentially do this?
His latest book is full of these other ways. Actually, Lomborg only wrote the conclusion. Various experts wrote sections putting forward different ideas, and a panel of top economists, including 3 Nobel laureates, picked those they liked most. They didn't like the tax, but they did like some geoengineering ideas. Cooling the globe by launching clouds of sulfur particles into the stratosphere, for instance, or spraying ocean water into the air to make more clouds. And the best way forward, Lomborg says, is to pour money into research so that down the road it won't cost a thing to shut down those coal-burning power plants.
Essentially make solar panels and all the other green energy technologies so cheap that everyone wants to buy them.
The money to pay for that R&D, $100 billion per year, would come from a global tax on coal, oil, and gas, but just a small tax, $7 per ton of carbon dioxide. Jonathan Lash, who's head of the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C., is not impressed.
It sounds like someone who did not think we should do anything about climate change now finding reasons why we shouldn't do very much.
The problem is urgent, Lash says. The warming we've seen so far amounts to just 0.8 degrees Celsius. Much more is coming.
Siberia is burning. Pakistan is underwater. There's record heat in the United States. It just isn't the time to offer research as a substitute for action.
Lash also says Lomborg's claims about the disastrous impact of taxing fossil fuels are way off the mark. So I called the researcher who did those calculations for Lomborg's book, Richard Toll at the Economic and Research Institute in Dublin, Ireland. And Toll says Lomborg is only telling part of the story. It's true, he says, bringing global warming to a screeching halt just by taxing fossil fuels would be enormously expensive. But his model shows that a more modest carbon tax could be cost-effective.
If you reduce emissions by a little bit, it's fairly cheap.
And those first cuts in carbon dioxide emissions bring the biggest benefits because they prevent the most extreme warming.
if you avoid the worst bit of climate change, that's going to bring a lot of benefits, but the benefits of reducing it further get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Also, says Toll, much of that new clean technology that Lomborg hopes for may not appear without a carbon tax. Green technologies already exist, but they won't take over until dirty energy gets more expensive. Dan Charles, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Rhoda Jansen is the author of Mennonite in a Little Black Dress, a memoir of going home. When we asked her to write an essay for our series, My Guilty Pleasure, in which authors talk about a book they're embarrassed to love, she picked a real winner, a book with terrible prose and a plotline that revolves around cannibalism, the apocalypse, and ruby laser rings.
Once when I was 9, my Mennonite mother busted me for reading during a spectacularly dull sermon that looped around and around like one of those Hindenburg bees. I had smuggled in a tasty book from the adult section of the church library. Of course, I knew that my mother wouldn't want me reading it, but it was too exciting to put down. Salem Kurban's 666, helpfully subtitled A Thrilling Bestseller of the Tribulation, told the portentous tale of a believer named George who had accepted Jesus into his heart. In evangelical parlance, George was saved. But there was a catch. See, he'd come to conversion a tad late in the game. The punchline of 666 was that the second coming of Jesus had already happened. Jesus had returned and picked his teams, and the resulting mayhem made the early Christian martyrs look like a lot of sissy pants. I was a fan of the early Christian martyrs. They were stripped naked and savaged by tigers. But as a group, they just couldn't compete with poor George and his thrilling tribulation. As a Mennonite, I had never heard the word rapture deployed in Kurban's hushed apocalyptic sense. This book confirmed how very much I'd been missing in my sheltered Mennonite life. Antichrist, cannibalism, global famine, apocalyptic doom. What's not to love? Our friend George took a pustulant 666 brand to the forehead and was forced to subsist on protein cakes made from the corpses of other tardy believers. How could I possibly have put this book down to sit through a windy sermon in which cannibalism wouldn't even be mentioned? I therefore concealed 666 in my Bible and bowed my head over it as if in prayer. I hoped that people would think I was a meditative child with no unwholesome interest in protein cakes. When I read 666 again as a grown-up, I still had a good time. The sheer, overwhelming badness of the prose was deeply satisfying. The shifting point of view, the character development of the Antichrist, the weird science involving ruby laser rings. There was even an inexplicable photograph of a crowd of people waving brooms. I don't know about you, but I like this kind of teaser. What are the brooms for? Are they brandishing the brooms in anger? Or did Jesus and the raptured Christians leave a lot of leftover rubbish, as at the movie theater? That's good stuff. Eschatology is maybe the worst literary genre of all time, but it's still my guilty pleasure. I read it furtively on airplanes. You've got to do something these days on airplanes, because they don't even give you a cracker, let alone a protein cake.
Rhoda Jansen is the author of Mennonite in a Little Black Dress, a memoir of going home. Her choice for My Guilty Pleasure is 666 by Salem Kurban. And you'll find more guilty pleasures, book reviews, and recommendations at our website, npr.org.
More All Things Considered right after this.